Well, I find that as I get older, there's lots of things that happen. You know, I told you a couple weeks ago, I have to start using glasses to see, which is the most annoying thing in the world, by the way, if you know what I mean. If you're less than, like, younger than 45, you have no idea how good you have it yet. If you're older than 45, I'm feeling your pain just a little bit. But one of the things that I miss, as I get older, my kids get older, and when they were younger, we used to go to playgrounds. You know, we used to go to play places like a McDonald's. And I used to love sitting there watching them play around, or even those places in the mall where all those kids are running around and screaming and the parents are on the side hoping the kids get all their energy out. I used to love those places. Now, I know what you're thinking. You might be thinking, wait, you let your kids play in those germ-infested, snot-caked play places like that? Yes, I did. And I actually encourage my kids to eat dirt. And if they find gum on the ground, go ahead and chew it again. So the truth is that while we were in South America, we had a very different sense of sanitation. And while we were gone, you guys all became germaphobes. It's true. When we came back, there were all kinds of things that were funny. I remember getting on the airplane and everybody had white masks on. And I thought, why does everybody have a white mask on? Did I not get the memo or what? So then we sat down, and before the plane boarded, the flight attendants came down with, like, Lysol spray, spraying it over our heads, and we thought, what is going on? That's really strange. And then we get back to the States, and everybody was carrying around hand sanitizer. We didn't even know what it was, and if you don't know what hand sanitizer is, I don't either. It's white goo, and it seems like it's now a socially acceptable thing to put hand sanitizer on your hand after you shake somebody's hand. How did we get there? It's a very funny thing to me. Now, when we were in Paraguay, we didn't have things like hand sanitation. In fact, the world was very different there. When you go to somebody's house, they put a 2-liter of pop in the middle and one glass, and everybody shared the same thing. That's how life was. We pooped in outhouses. It's been a while since some of you have done that. You should try it again. It's not the most sanitary way of using a bathroom. So that's the world we lived in. And even now, there's things that I see that are sometimes funny, like you go into Walmart. Not that I'm going to knock Walmart, James. He's on the sound, so he's going to turn me down just for a second. But anyway, you have the sanitizer wipes now for the grocery carts. Have you ever seen those? Have you ever used those? Probably you have, because you're a bunch of germaphobes now. I remember when we were pushing around our kids back in the day, and I turned around and my kid was licking. I think it was Zach. He's like licking the handle, like, ah, don't do that. Ah. Right. So anyway, yeah, we let our kids play and play places, and then eat their food right away without putting hand sanitizer on. We're kind of those kinds of parents. Some of you are more like Bubble Boy suits for your children. You know, you don't want them to have any germs at all. But anyway, that has nothing to do with anything. I just thought it was interesting. So anyway. Back to the play place. Do you remember when your kids would go to a play place or a playground or whatever, and they climb all the way up to the top? Maybe they're on the top of the slide, or they're on the top of the jungle gym or whatever, and they yell, "Hey, Daddy, do you see me?" Or, "Hey, Mom, do you see me?" And they go up the slide. Hey, and like 42 times in 20 minutes, they're like, "Mom, do you see me? Dad, do you see me?" You put them on the merry-go-round, and they go around and around and around, right? And every time they go around, "Hi, Mom. Hi, Mom. Hi, Mom. Hi, Mom. Hi, Mom." And so finally, you just leave your hand up, right? Like this. So they know that you're actually watching them. Now, what's interesting, as my kids get older, it's not play place anymore, but it's equally, "Hey, here's my report card. Hey, here's my academics. Hey, here's my sport. Here, did you see me in band? Did you see me in choir?" It's like, do we ever grow out of wanting our mom and dad to see us, to see what we're doing, to be proud of us? There's something in us that we like it when dad is watching. And I think when we know that dad is watching, we feel like we're not alone. That if we needed something, dad would come running and just that quick to help us, to save us, to do what we need. It's interesting how that works. And I feel like even as an adult, you know, I love my wife, but when I get sick, I still kind of want mommy. I don't know why. It's just something that's inside of me. But there's a part of that that when we believe that dad is watching, everything feels a little bit more safe. And I think that's one of the reasons why we love this story a little bit in this beloved miracle in Matthew chapter 14. And I invite you to go to either your Bible or the new Bible that's in the chair in front of you. By the way, there are new Bibles down there. If you don't have an ESV and you'd like one, feel free to steal from the church. It's fine. I give you permission. Take that thing home if you would like it. Matthew chapter 14. So this is, if you ask people, what are some of your favorite miracles in the Bible? I'm sure Jesus walking on the water would be listed among the favorites. So let's read this, Matthew chapter 14, beginning in verse 22. It says, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on a high mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against it. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It is a ghost," and they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and began to sink and cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took a hold of him, saying, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat and the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Now, in order to understand what's going on here, we actually have to look at the story before. And the story before, if you look in your Bible, is the feeding of the 5,000. Now, the feeding of the 5,000 is found, there's only two miracles that are found in every one of the Gospels, in all four Gospels. It's the resurrection of Christ and the feeding of the 5,000. Now, in order to understand the second part, the walking on the water, we need to understand a little bit about the first part of Jesus feeding the 5,000, because that's how we got there. So if you can imagine a little bit, the story of the feeding of the 5,000. They're up on the side of the hill. Jesus has been talking all day. The people are hungry. Out comes a boy. He's got some fish. He's got some loaves. Jesus feeds all 5,000 men, 10,000 probably women, 12,000 total, with five loaves and two fishes. So if you think about it just a little bit, he feeds all of those people with bread that was never baked and fish that never swam. And he fed them all, and there were 12 baskets left over. So that's the feeding of the 5,000. Immediately after the feeding of the 5,000, we have this story of Jesus walking on the water. But the connection that you have to make is that after Jesus fed the 5,000, the people wanted to make him their king. And who would blame them? I mean, who wouldn't want a king that could feed them with five loaves and two fishes? He could feed the entire country. They wouldn't have to work anymore. It'd be a great, great king to have. In fact, in John 8, at the end of the story of Jesus walking on the water, it's the next day now, the people come and they find Jesus again. Why? Because they're hungry. It's like feeding a stray cat. It keeps coming back, right? So you feed the people one day, the next day they're going to go, "Hey, I got a free meal. Let's go find Jesus again." And so the people wanted to make him king. There was like a coup that was going on. Let's grab him. Let's make him our king. And Jesus immediately made his disciples get in the boat, and Jesus left to go. So we got to understand the feeding of the 5,000. They wanted to make Jesus king in order to understand Jesus walking on the water. The story unfolds in along the Sea of Galilee. Now, the Sea of Galilee is a really interesting place because the Sea of Galilee sits 700 feet below sea level. And surrounding the Sea of Galilee is kind of like a bowl with a mountain range that reaches all the way up to 4,000 feet above sea level around it. So it sits in this bowl. You have the Sea of Galilee, which isn't a huge, huge, like, it's not like it's the Mediterranean, but it sits in the bowl surrounded by this mountainside. Now, what that means is that the Sea of Galilee is really susceptible to huge storms because the cold air from the top of the mountains meets the warm air rising from the water, and suddenly, even still today, these violent storms in the matter of minutes with huge wind begins to churn around inside the bowl around this mountain range. Still happens today. So in the story, when Jesus sends the disciples away, he sends them out into the Sea of Galilee. Now, some of them are fishermen, right? They know how to handle a boat. It's not like they're the first times out there. Like, ever take somebody canoeing for the first time, and they got no idea what they're doing? These guys, they know what they were doing, and they go out in the boat. And what we find is that 9 hours later, they're still out in the boat. And 9 hours later, maybe what we don't realize in this story, 7 miracles happen. You see, in this story, there's actually 7 miracles, not one. In just about every one of the miracles of Christ, he comes and he heals, right? Or he comes and he turns water to wine. He comes and he does one thing. But in this story, he does 7 things. There are 7 miracles in this story, which might be one of the reasons why we love the story so much. So what I want to try to do is I want to walk through 6 of the 7 miracles and save one for the end. So the first miracle that we come to is actually Jesus walking on the water. And I think because we've heard the story so many times, we're no longer intrigued by the idea. So let me remind you, if you jump in the water, you sink. Everybody knows that. Some sink a little faster, some a little slower. We all sink. That's what happens. So we don't appreciate Jesus walking on the water that way because we've heard that story so much. But what we really don't appreciate is Jesus walking on the water in the midst of a huge storm. You see, in our minds sometimes, it's like this placid lake that's nice and calm, and Jesus is walking across it, right? He's like a water strider on top of the water tension. He's walking along. But when we realize that there's this huge storm, and there's swells, and there's waves going on, and the water, and because of the wind, there's water is like spitting all around, how did Jesus walk on that? Like, did he, like, march up one wave and, like, slide down the next? I mean, how did that happen? You ever think about that? These are big waves, so big that the professional fishermen couldn't even get their boat going in the right direction. So it's not Jesus, like, serenely walking across the lake like it's no big deal. He's either climbing and sliding the waves, or there's a little, like, Red Sea kind of thing going on, right, where it opens up nice and calm in the middle where he kind of walks through. We don't know. But he walked on the water. And unless you live in Minnesota, you know, in Minnesota you walk on the water every winter, so it's no big deal. But that's the first of the miracles, right? Second miracle, Peter walks on the water. Now, I love this part of the story for a lot of different reasons, but as the story goes along, Jesus is walking along, and the disciples see him walking out on the water, and they think it's Casper. And you know, it's a funny part, but fear does funny things to the mind. People say funny things. They do funny things. I'm one of the kind of guys that I love going to, like, haunted houses. I like that feeling of, like, goosebumps. Or do you guys call them goose pimples here? I don't know. Goose pimples? Goosebumps? Again, I never know what you guys say funny things like Washington. I don't know what to do with that. So you get goosebumps. I like that. And, in fact, I mentioned to Amanda that it'd be really fun to have a youth group haunted house at the insane asylum out west of town. Wouldn't that be a really cool place to have it? You know, they did like waterboarding out there and electroshock therapy. I just see the youth group kids in there and youth leaders are doing like, zzz, it'd be great. Anyway, I think that'd be really fun. So these disciples, they're out there, but my point is that they were afraid. And when you're afraid, you do and you say very, very funny things. And when they see Jesus out there and they realize that it's Jesus, Peter makes this very unusual request. Lord, if it's you, I want to come out. Now, people try to spiritualize it like crazy and that he just wanted to be near Jesus. Well, I think as a fisherman, he knew it was way safer in the boat than out on the water. But we've heard the story so many times. Have you thought about how that actually works? You, Peter, who knows he's going to sink if he steps out of the boat, right? He climbs over on the stern side. How did he test the water? So you climb over the boat, right? Did he, like, stick a toe in? Bloop, bloop, bloop. Right? Do you think he just, like, jumped out? Like, Spider-Man jumped right out in the water? Or did he test the water? Boom, boom, boom. you know, holding on to the boat. We don't know how he did it. He got out of the boat knowing he should sink, but he didn't. I love that. But what I really love is how Peter gets a bad rap in the story. Only one guy got out of the boat. 11 chickens were back in the boat going, "What are you thinking? Why do we make fun of Peter like he was the one of little faith when the 11 other chickens didn't get out of the boat at all?" So don't miss that he walked in the water, but also don't miss he was the only one that got out. Third miracle, he starts to sink. So he gets somewhat close to Jesus, and you know, it's really funny that Jesus renames Peter the Rock. Well, here you have the Rock who starts to sink, which is ironic in my own head. But you have Peter out there, and he sees the wave. Somehow he takes his eyes off Jesus. He grows afraid, or maybe we should say even more afraid than he was, right? And he begins to sink. Now remember, he's the only one that got out of the boat. Remember, there's 11 chickens back in the boat that never gave it a try. But faith and risk are kind of that way. You know, if you never try anything great for Jesus, you'll never do anything great for Jesus. You got to try it in order to accomplish it. So let's not judge Peter so harshly for getting out of the boat. So then he starts to sink. Now, the reason I think this is a miracle is because the word sink is either all go or all no, right? You don't slowly start to sink in the water, do you? So he slowly starts, you know, sinking in the water. And just because I think that Jesus had a great sense of humor that we don't appreciate, Jesus catches him. Now, if you were Jesus, what would you have done at that moment? "You're slipping, I can't hold on." Would you, like, dip his head a few times? "Oh, there you go, oh, ah." Ah! That's what I would do. Just because it would be fun. Now, I'm sure as a fisherman, he knew how to swim, right? So the swimming part wasn't going to be a problem. So why was he so afraid to sink? Maybe the storm. Maybe he'd been rowing for 9 hours. He was afraid. And I think it's a great reminder that it's not failure that shapes us. It's the way we respond to failure that really shapes us. And we see this in this story. And in a lot of ways, I think we should admire Peter instead of saying he was the one of little faith. The fourth miracle here, and I'll just walk through these next ones a little bit, but the fourth miracle is, it says that as soon as he climbed in the boat, the wind and the waves die down. Now, that doesn't just happen. Even when the storm goes away, when the waves are still going on, right? So he climbs in the boat and immediately, psh. And Jesus didn't even have to say, "Peace, be still," like he did the last time he calmed the storm. They climb in the boat, which, by the way, climbing in the boat in the middle of a storm, if you've ever tried to do something like that, it's not the easiest thing in the world, right? Climbs in the boat, psh. The wind and the waves cease. And all you have are a bunch of disciples with their mouths hanging open, looking at the drowned rat Peter that just got out of the water with Jesus. The fifth miracle. We read in John 6, which is the parallel passage to this, that as soon as they climbed back in the boat lands where they were going. Now, I don't know if this is like the first speedboat in history, but somehow when they climbed back in the boat and the wind and the waves die, immediately they were at where they were going. Now, it could have been that all the disciples were looking this way. They didn't realize the shore was coming behind them. I don't think that's quite how it happened. Somehow, after 9 hours of rowing, all they wanted to do was get to shore. And as soon as Jesus climbed in the boat, they were at the shore. How did that happen? We don't really know. But it seems like the disciples, they had the anchor misplaced. They thought the shore was going to be safety. They didn't realize that safety had just climbed in the boat with them. And I think that's significant. I realized this week as I was studying this that at this point of the story, all of the church of Jesus Christ fit in one little boat. And if that boat had gone down, all of the church of Jesus Christ at this point would have gone down with it. But Jesus comes and he saves them, which leads to the last miracle, the sixth miracle, that the disciples believed. So after seeing Jesus walk in the water, they see Peter walk in the water, the waves die down immediately, and then they're at shore. The disciples turn to Jesus and they say, "Truly, you are the Son of God." We got to remember that the greatest miracle that God does and has ever done in history throughout this entire time is when he takes somebody who's not a believer and he turns them into somebody who believes. So sometimes you can get online, you can Google, does God still do miracles? And people want to talk about the healing type miracles or all these extraordinary things. The greatest miracle that God still does today is when he takes somebody and he turns them into a follower of Jesus Christ. That heart transformation, that old man to new man, the old is gone, the new has come. When they put on the righteousness of Christ, God still does that today, and it is the greatest miracle he does. I love in this story as I look at it, you have the disciples and they're fumbling through following Jesus, and they see him feed 5,000, they see all that he does here, and only then do they conclude, "You are the Son of God." How did they not conclude that after the feeding of the 5,000? I mean, are they so clueless at this point that they just, was he only just like an okay guy before that? Okay, I see you fed 10,000 people, and that's all right. But now that you walked on water, truly you are the Son of God. I love that when we look at the stories of the Bible and as we look at what goes on in our lives, I love that Jesus takes us where we are at. He takes chickens that won't get out of the boat, and he takes the brash guy who says, "I'm going over the side." He takes us exactly where we are at. In fact, in the story that Wayne read a little while ago, that's the story. You have the self-righteous Pharisee, and you have the tax collector. Well, the tax collector is the criminal. He's the one that's stealing from the people. He's the traitor. He's given into Rome. He's all the wrong things. But Jesus says that's the guy that's justified. So perhaps you sit here week after week and you listen to me and you're a part of worship and you kind of know us, but there's a part of your heart that wonders, would Jesus want somebody like me? I mean, does he know the kind of guy that I really am? Does he know what's going on in my head? Does he know what's in my heart? Because if he really does, there's no way he would want somebody like me. Friend, I want you to know that if that's how you are on the inside, you're exactly the kind of person that Jesus chases after. He doesn't chase after the self-righteous religious one. He chases after the screw-ups. It's almost like the more you screw up in life, the more Jesus goes, "Hey, you're even a better candidate now." So maybe you sit and you wonder and you think about those things, but I just want you to know that at some point, I want you to stop running from Jesus and let him catch you. I would love it if you had this kind of disciple moment where all of a sudden you realize truly he is the Son of God. And in that moment, what happens in you is the greatest miracle of all. He takes the old man and it becomes new. He saves you. He gives you an eternity. He gives you a future. He gives you a family. He gives you a father. He gives you all of those things if you would just stop running away from him because you think you're not good enough for him. We never see that in Scripture. We see him going after the chickens. We see him going after the self-righteous. We see him going after these people. Stop running. Turn to him and say, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Now, I told you that there are at least 7 miracles in this story, and I've now walked through 6. But I saved perhaps the most amazing one, the most overlooked one, for the end, because I think it's so unbelievable. But I need to set it up a little bit with some of the parallel passages to this. So if you turn over to John chapter 6 with me, I want to read some of the parallel passage to Jesus walking on the water. John chapter 6. So this is going to set up this last miracle. John 6 verse 16. Here we just have a few verses. Matthew is the only one that includes the Peter part of the story with Jesus walking on the water. So verse 16 says, "When evening came, the disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea, coming near the boat, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." What John adds in here is how far offshore the boat was. 3 or 4 miles. 4 miles, let's say. So the boat has now gone 4 miles. What's also interesting is when they got into the boat to go to Capernaum, it was on the same side of the Sea of Galilee that they already were. In a sense, they just had to go up the shoreline. And in the midst of a big storm, if you've ever been out in a boat in the middle of a lake in the big storm, what you want to do is you want to find the shoreline. You hug the shoreline because it's safety. So here you have some disciples that probably should have stayed along shore that are out in the middle of this big storm, and they get pushed 4 miles out into the Sea of Galilee. Now, the next one that I want you to see is the Mark chapter 6 one. So turn over to Mark chapter 6. We'll look at that same parallel passage now. And it adds one additional element. Mark 6, we have verse 45. He makes him get into the boat. Verse 46, he went up on the mountaintop to pray. Remember, there are mountains all the way around the Sea of Galilee that rise up to 4,000 feet. The Sea of Galilee is 700 feet below sea level, right? But look what it says in verse 48, and I think this is the amazing miracle that we miss here. It says, "And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea." Let me explain why this is amazing. The fourth watch of the night is about 4 a.m. in the morning. The disciples have been out there rowing against the waves and against the wind for 9 hours. They're 4 miles out to sea. Jesus climbs a mountain 4,000 feet high. So let me ask you this. Verse 48, it says, "And he saw them." How did he see them? It's the middle of the night. They're 4 miles away. He's up on the high mountain. How did he see them? How did he see them? How did he see? How did he know that they were in trouble? How did he know that they were tired? How did he know that they were painfully, is the word that's used, painfully out in the boat going against the waves? How did he see that? I think this is actually the universal question when hard times hit in life. Does anybody see? Does anybody care? There's something in us when we're walking through really hard times that we feel like we are invisible. Nobody knows. Nobody cares. We're all alone. And maybe that's how the disciples felt while they were out in the boat. And maybe that's how Jesus saw them. I don't know. But he saw them in the middle of the night from arguably 5 miles away. And he saw and he knew and he went to them. There's a story in the Old Testament about a servant girl named Hagar who runs away from her master with her son. And as the story goes, she goes as far as she can. They have no more food, no more water. She sits down to die. And in that moment, the Lord comes and talks to her. And he says 3 words. He says, "I see you. I see you." So in that moment, in Genesis 16:13, there's one little verse that I just really love. And this is Hagar who turns to the Lord and says, "You are the God who sees me. You are the God who sees me." And gives him a name. It is El, which is God. El is the Hebrew word for God. El Roy, R-O-I. El Roy, the God who sees me. The God who sees me. So if we go back to our story, we have the disciples out in the boat. They're 9 hours of rowing. They're against the wind. They're tired. They're wet. They're afraid. And even though Jesus just filled their bellies, they wondered, where is Jesus? Has he forgotten us? We're out in the middle of the lake in this big storm. We're going down. Doesn't he know that we're the disciples? We're the main men. Come on, Jesus, where are you? Have you forgotten us? Oh, sure, he could give us food. Oh, sure, he could turn the water to wine. But does he see us right now? Does he feel my pain? Does he feel my fear? Will he be here when I need him? And one of the things, one of the lies that are whispered in our ears in times of trouble is that God doesn't care. He doesn't see. He's too far away. He's too busy to bother with me. And it is not true. In fact, I want to show you 4 or 5 verses here. First one out of Jeremiah 12:3. Here's what it says. He says, "But you, O Lord, know me. See me and test my heart toward you." Psalm 34:15. "The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous and his ears toward their cry." Psalm 33:13. "The Lord looks down from heaven and he sees all the sons of men. From his dwelling place he looks out on all the inhabitants of the earth. He who fashions the hearts of them, he who understands all their works." Isaiah 44:17. "The idols do not see you. Their eyes are plastered over so they cannot see." Listen, you will never go through a storm so dark that it escapes the notice of the God who sees. You will never go through a storm so dark that it escapes the notice of the God who sees. And I can't give you a reason for that hard thing in life and why it seems like bad things happen to good people, and why there's pain and there's suffering and there's loss. There's so many times that I wonder why things happen and why hurts and loss and all of those things. I can't explain all of those things, but I can tell you this. No matter what that dark, that hard, that fear is in your life, God sees it. He is the God who sees, which means that you are never alone. You are never invisible. You never walk through that hard moment, that hard thing, that hard life, that hard situation. You're never in a season of life where God turns a blind eye to you. He sees all. He knows what you're going through. He is El Roy, the God who sees you. One person wrote this, and I don't often do longer quotes, but I just thought, for me anyway, it was just so, so helpful. Wrote, "If you have never been rejected or cast aside, if you have never felt all alone, thinking no one knows, no one cares, no one understands, if you've never been misunderstood, mistreated, or suffered unjustly at the hands of another, if you've never been used, abused, not wanted, or not loved, if you've never suffered alone, lost in a wilderness of hurt, pain, and secrets, then the name, the God who sees me, may not have a great impact on you. But if you have ever felt all alone, dying in an emotional wilderness, you will be comforted and encouraged to know that El Roy always sees, always knows, and always understands as he meets us in our suffering." So feel free to wonder why certain things happen, but never question whether God sees what you are going through. And perhaps the reason why he walked on the water, and as you read especially John 6, he sees them out there, and he says, and it says, and he went to them. He sees the storm, he sees their fear, sees that they're tired, and he goes to them. Could it be that the reason he walked on water is because he sees? There's a great prayer that a guy named Thomas A. Kempis wrote a long time ago as part of his prayers and meditations. And I want to end with this prayer, and I have it for you because I think it's so beautiful. He wrote, and remember, it's a prayer, "Write your blessed name, O Lord, upon my heart. there to remain so indelibly engraved that no prosperity, that no adversity shall ever, ever move me from your love. Be to me a strong tower of defense, a comfort, a comforter in tribulation, a deliverer in distress, and a faithful guide to the courts of heaven through the many temptations and dangers of this life. Oh, Jesus, my only Savior. He is the God who sees you. And that's the beauty of this story. And I want that to be an encouragement to you, no matter what you're going through today. Father, sometimes it's really hard for us to believe this is true. It's one thing to read it on the pages, and it's a whole other thing to just realize that the God in heaven who is keeping all of the universe together with his power, the God in heaven who sees all that is going on and knows what's going on, knows the hearts of every man, woman, and child, the God who is intricately involved in the affairs of men and governments, the God who is tracking comets and asteroids, who sees planets and suns, that same God sees all that we are going through. And in the midst of our big storms, you come. Lord, honestly, sometimes it feels like you don't come. That you're too far away, that you're too busy. So Lord, I pray for all of those who maybe today feel so alone and forgotten and invisible, that they would be filled with the hope of these words, that you are El Roy, the God who sees them. Lord, it's amazing that you would love us that way, that you would be preoccupied with us in that way. Who are we to catch the eye of the Almighty? All we can do really is step back in awe and say, thank you for seeing. Fill us, Lord, with the hope of these words. You are the God who sees. In Jesus' name, amen.